Good morning, and thank you for attending session 222, titled Rise Strong After Divorce. Please silence your cell phones and be respectful during the session. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. At the desk, you can purchase other Sunstone merchandise with our More Than One Way to Mormon logo. We also encourage you to check out the bookstore in the center ballroom. Please support Benchmark Books by purchasing a book or two. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. About this session, divorce affects over 50% of families in the Mormon community. The resulting trauma quickly buries family members in a swamp of shame and loss. It is possible to rise strong and wise after divorce and learn new mountain climbing skills. How can individuals reach out and assist others in this climb toward healing and growth? Family mediator Elizabeth Dalton will share trail wisdom gained over 25 years of guiding families after divorce. Elizabeth A. Dalton is a seasoned family law attorney who helped pioneer family mediation in Utah as an alternative to divorce litigation. She is the author of Healing Hearts, Helping Adults and Children to Recover from Divorce. Elizabeth.
Well, welcome. I'm Liz Dalton, and appreciate this opportunity. I have a presentation. It's about 45 minutes, but I wanted to leave at least 15 minutes for questions. And so just if you have questions, just, you know, we have a small enough group. If you have just a compelling question, I'll probably break and answer it, okay? I'm curious who's in the room. So by a raise of hands, do you have someone in your life, a friend, close family member who's struggling with divorce? Any of you personally struggling with divorce? I've been there. I know it. I know this terrain well. Okay. I used to be a very perfect LDS woman. Very, very perfect. I was so perfect that I spoke at the 1998 BYU Women's Conference on divorce and remarriage. I was so perfect. For BYU to even have a topic on divorce at the Women's Conference, I thought was pretty amazing. Okay. So, and it was because I sort of did divorce the perfect way, where I divorced a husband who I met at BYU, and he was an Eagle Scout, an AP on his mission, but he left the church. So, of course, I had to divorce, because when you're perfect, you don't listen. You don't seek understanding. You just have to be right and very righteous. So we divorced, and then I followed Spencer W. Kimball's formula. You marry a very faithful LDS man, and then you will have a happy marriage. So I found the most orthodox LDS man I could possibly find from Idaho. So we got married after dating 10 weeks. And struggled in incompatibility, just struggled for 13 years. And we were blending kids. And then finally, my daughter, because of perfectionism, I was such a perfect Mormon mother, developed an eating disorder, which was my wake-up call. And so as I went into therapy, the perfectionism started unraveling. And before I knew it, I just woke up and I realized I was married in the most incompatible way. I was miserably unhappy. So I divorced a second time, which, you know, in the LDS community, full of shame when you divorce. And a second time, something really is wrong with you. So That was my call into the wilderness. And who's familiar with the hero's journey? Yes, Professor Joseph Campbell. He appeared on PBS and was sharing about world literature, and he explained so well that in every world culture, there are stories and myths about the hero's journey. And the hero starts in a community of established rules and expectations, but something calls the hero or the heroine out from the community and into the wilderness and into adventure, where you struggle with your demons and you find strength and grace appears and you learn and grow. And, you know, from Star Wars, Luke Skywalker crashes into the swamp, and there he meets Yoda and goes into a dark cave of, you know, his own personal struggle. And then there's Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. And, you know, she just struggles with the established norms that, you know, you must marry for security and to take care of your parents. And she decides to go against society and marry for love. So even Christ did a hero's journey. Before his mission, he went 40 years in the wilderness. And so I had the opportunity to get called out into the wilderness with my second divorce. And I started unraveling so much and struggling, and eventually I started watching Escape from Polygamy on one of the cable shows, started seeing myself in the women, and so then I did the most grievous sin. I found Mormon Stories. And so then, you know, went into a full-blown faith crisis. Then I met up again with a friend, California Mormon, Northern California. So married a third time, and we've been in the wilderness together, and it's been really amazing because I discovered Dr. Brené Brown and trained with her and her faculty in Texas, and completely reinvented my mediation practice. I used to be a very perfect, highly skilled mediator in Utah, you know, with excellent skills in having empathy with all the different stories and bridging people together. And, you know, very, had a huge practice working with attorneys. Well, then, after I trained with Dr. Brené Brown and her staff and my supervisors, I realized, wait, divorce is an opportunity for families to be called out into the wilderness and to begin a hero's journey. And so my mediation practice is highly creative. I bring in coaching based on workshop materials of Brené Brown. I bring in my husband. He's a divorced dad. I have my one of my daughters who's a counselor. She works with the children. She's a kids coach. And so we just have a highly creative, very unique practice. And I try and get clients before they go to divorce attorneys, before they get in the mess of litigation. So I work a lot with counselors throughout the state of Utah and save their clients. But I wanted to take you through sort of an outline of what I do to invite my clients to do their wilderness journey. And I use the metaphor of a mountain climb. And I essentially am a trail guide. And I invite them to have lots of trail guides in the wilderness, because the more help you have, you know, the more grace you have in your journey. And so those of you that have friends, family members that are going to struggle with divorce, those that are struggling themselves, I'm going to take you on the trail today. And we're going to rise strong from divorce, and I'll give you an overview of how you climb and enjoy the wilderness. But first, I want to start with some fun facts. In America, we get married, especially in comparison to Europe, Australia. 90% of Americans will marry sometime in their lifetime. During the 60s and 70s, our divorce rate peaked to about 50% for first marriages. Now, since that time, we have experienced a decline in divorce. So currently, one-third of current marriages will end in divorce. I've always thought this was interesting. Two-thirds of all divorces are initiated by women. And then in Utah, we have a pattern where we marry young, we divorce, and we remarry quickly. And so it's not uncommon that they're, you know, I'll have clients that are on their third or fourth divorce. It's very common in Utah. There's lots of causes for divorce. Every divorce has unique divorce stories. I got this from the Huffington Post. These are the top causes of divorce right now. Incompatibility, infidelity, failed bids for affection and connection over time, financial stress, immaturity, emotional abuse, addiction, mental health issues. So there's a wide variety of why divorce happens. There's a researcher, John Gottman, up in Washington State, who has his famous love lab. And he has now predicted, through listening to conversations of couples, to 96% accuracy. Just from their conversations, he can tell if divorce is inevitable. In an argument, in conversations, you can, you know, actually see if you're in the danger zone. And he calls them the four horsemen of the apocalypse. If you have chronic criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling, if that's showing up in conversations over and over again, it is a predictor of divorce because these four patterns will lead to loneliness, negativity, anger, resentment, which unravels the relationship. Divorce rates are declining because we have new patterns in our society. In 1960, women married young. The average age was 20, and the average age for men was 23. In 2012, the median age has now increased. Women are waiting until they're 27 on average, and 29 for men. So we're getting married later. There's more cohabitation, and then education makes a difference. The more educated you are, the more educated your children are, the less likely they are to get divorced. Then we have less marriages based on accidental pregnancy. You know, birth control has really helped. And so we have less of those marriages where, you know, they get married young because there was an accidental pregnancy. And we have more marriages based on partnership, where there's two incomes, there's shared parenting, there's shared household chores. So the expectation for marriage has changed. It's more, you know, hoping to be a partnership. But the nuclear family is now on the decline. We only have 46% of children that are being raised in the traditional nuclear family of, you know, the first marriage, two spouses.
Where's the other 20%?
Yeah. Well, then we have 34% in single-parent households, and then the rest are in what is called the contemporary family, which are grandparents raising children, foster children. You know, we now have what we call contemporary and restructured families, you know, are becoming the new norm. Oh, okay, did you get it? Okay. And then I'm always asked, what is the best age to marry? And we actually have research on this at the University of Utah. And it's between 29 and 34. That's the Goldilocks time to get married. And so I have done my best to coach all my kids, all my stepkids, you know, wait. There's no hurry. And that's because adolescence doesn't really end until your late 20s. And so developmentally, you're still deciding who you are, what your values are, what your life direction is. And so, yeah, the longer a young adult can wait to make that marriage decision, you know, it's wisest. Now, starting in junior high, we all started experiencing the trauma of breaking up from a crush that we had in high school or in college. We're wired for connection. And so when we experience, you know, a significant connection disraveling or not there anymore, and we experience the trauma of disconnection. And it's very traumatic. My clients that are struggling with divorce, they have what I call a trauma brain. And they just are not themselves. They get fixated on why this is happening. They try and second guess. And they can't sleep because their mind is spinning. They get so desperate. You know, in every divorce, in most cases, there's a decision maker, and one must accept the decision. And so, you know, the one that is not the decision maker gets so desperate, trying to hang on. And you feel lost, and you have a loss of identity. You've lost yourself somewhere in a dysfunctional marriage. Lots of my clients, they'll self-medicate, you know, in a variety of ways because the trauma and pain is so, so deep and so profound. My clients always return to adolescent behavior, okay? I have to forewarn them on that. But it makes sense because in adolescence is when you actually found yourself and you defined yourself. So it makes sense to me. But there's so much overwhelming sadness and then lots of craziness. And so that's why we have all these really crazy things we hear about on the news, you know, especially when a marriage or romantic relationship has unraveled. People do go crazy. At the heart of the trauma of a romantic relationship disraveling or unraveling is grief. And that is what creates such storminess and waves of grief. And there's all these different stages of grief that come in and out as you're struggling with divorce. Shock, denial, pain and guilt, anger, betrayal, rejection, second guessing, trying to figure this out, sadness, depression. 60% of people going through a divorce will struggle with clinical depression. And then finally, hopefully, they reach acceptance and hope. But this is the swampland. This is where you can get stuck. And here's my trail map. I make it really simple for my clients and for, you know, I work with parents, I work with grandparents, I work with new parents, step-parents, because it is a mountain climb to get out of the swampland of grief and to get out of what I call negative intimacy, you know, where you just keep spinning in what I call your divorce story. And when you really dig deep in your divorce story, it's a victim story. And but it's possible to heal and move out of negative intimacy with your story, you know, with your former spouse, and move into a place I call caring indifference. And that's a place where you become an observer. You become an observer of your story. And you start unraveling it and learning lessons and wisdom. And then on the summit of this climb, I call compassion, where you actually grow into a place of peace, understanding, and you write a brave new story for your life. And so these are the three stages of healing that I work with all my clients and then teach the people in their lives how to be trail guides, you know, for their children that are struggling with divorce. You know, I just teach the trail. And then people can help others. And so I want to go into more detail. Negative intimacy is a phrase I learned from my mentor. I mentored with Dr. Brad Chappell down in Provo, who was a therapist and then became a life coach. And negative intimacy is the first stage that arises when a relationship that was significant in your life unravels. And lots of negative emotions arise and stories. And negative intimacy comes from the part of our brain that's wired for self-protection. It's our limbic system, our reptilian brain, and this brain automatically goes into gear as soon as you experience the trauma of disconnection. And we all have our favorite styles because our primal brain is just so well wired for fight, flight, or freeze. And as I describe, you know, these three styles, consider, like, what's your favorite style? Fight, flight, or freeze. And I'm going to go through each one. When you're in the swampland of negative intimacy, you know, when you're... And this happens even if you're married or if you're in a relationship with someone you care about. It's just in divorce, it's really, really swampy. But no, this happens in all our relationships. Whenever we face emotional stress, we have a unmet expectation, you know, we get into an argument. Many of us will go into a fight response. And I love this lion because that's you feel really powerful when you're a fighter. And you stand your ground, you stand your principles, and you just feel so right about your position. And so from time to time, you'll see yourself doing a fight response, you know, in certain relationships. It's very common. Any fighters in the group? Yes. the reason you have to watch out for getting really mired in the swamp of being a fighter is fighting can lead to criticism, and it can lead to attacks and counterattacks and defensiveness, and so it can lead to danger. Another popular survival self-protection strategy is, you know, when you're in emotional stress and crisis in a relationship, you'll want to avoid and escape the situation. Anybody here that likes to seek flight? Yes, I happen. This is my favorite. I love to get in my car and drive to Nordstrom and just, you know, escape. I love that. And so it's really tempting when you're in, you know, a real emotionally charged, you know, relationship that has some crisis. Yeah, you'll want to escape. The danger zone with escaping and avoiding is you never deal with your problems, you know, and that causes a lot of frustration, like in your spouse or your co-parent. Lots of frustration shows up with other people, and then, or with your children, though they, teenagers especially, tend to be avoiders. And it can lead to addictions, because this is where, you know, self-medication really, really works, and you just go for it, because it just absolutely helps you avoid. And then, your primal brain will have you freeze. And to survive and to protect, you'll go into a pleasing type way of trying to deal with the crisis in a relationship. And you'll please and accommodate. And again, you know, you might have some short-term results. But long-term, if you're a pleaser and an accommodator, you will do so much self-sacrifice that you will lose that sense of yourself. You'll become a doormat, and you'll lose self-respect. And then what happens, the swampland of freezing, is you can be a little passive-aggressive because you'll just keep everything in and things are not getting resolved, and you'll go passive-aggressive. So that's the danger zone with that. But with my clients and with the people I train, you know, to be coaches with their family members, it is possible to get out of the swampland. But the place you have to climb up to is a place I call caring indifference. And it's a very different place from being in the swirl and confusion of negative intimacy. It's a place where you choose ways to calm down your brain and become an observer and step out of the swamp. And caring indifference, you have to do it. I mean, it's the only way to get to the summit is you have to take a time out and calm the brain because, you know, your primal brain just surges with adrenaline and it just automatically takes over. And so you have to find ways, you know, with counseling, therapy, meditation. I'll give you some examples. Where you shift your brain function. You go from your primal brain, which is all about survival and self-protection, to having a peaceful brain where your higher cognitive functions like light up in a PET scan, where you have your reason and you have your logic and all the stress chemicals have calmed down so you can think clearly. And so this is where your best self shows up. And this is where you can set boundaries. In a divorce, this is where I train my clients that are parents to be co-parents. And I train them to be business-like, factual. So we keep the higher cognitive brain functioning. And they have them communicate by email, okay, where you can actually read and edit before you send. And it's where conscious uncoupling happens and where you practice just calming yourself down with exercise, yoga, and you're out of that negative swampland. And it's where you begin the healing journey. And then in time, I invite my clients, you know, to climb towards the summit where they can actually arrive at a place where they start having compassion and empathy for their former spouse. And this requires a lot of advanced mountain climbing skills. Mm-hmm. Because it always involves some type of forgiveness. And to even get to forgiveness, you always have to begin with self-compassion. And I love Kristen Neff's website on selfcompassion.org. It's a great, great resource. Because compassion begins with having self-compassion for yourself. And then I love Glennon Doyle Melton's definition of forgiveness, being a love warrior. The only way to live peacefully is to forgive everyone constantly, including yourself. And it's a practice. And when you, you know, have healed and evolved and are practicing all this great compassion, it's much easier to understand yourself, other people. It's a place where you can practice, you know, being your authentic self. You can, you know, cultivate gratitude and joy in your life, restore trust, and practice creativity and generosity. And this is why I weave in Brené Brown with my clients, because her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, is so helpful when you find yourself in the wilderness. Because the wilderness is full of imperfection, and there's so many gifts in the wilderness. And I love her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, because she gives you that trail map of, you know, really how to self-restore and find these practices that, you know, help you be your better self. So, and then I'm always working with, in my practice, because it's more of a family intervention practice, and I work by contract, and so anyone can coach with me and my team. So we have all sorts of extended family members showing up all the time. And I train them to be trail guides. And the model I use is the coaching model. And when you're a coach, you accept that you're an observer and that there's nothing to fix. And that's a really hard concept for a lot of parents and grandparents that we work with to accept. Because, you know, when a divorce happens in your family, you know, you just want to fix it. You want to hire the most expensive attorney. And you want to just get in there and make it all better. But in the wilderness, there's nothing to fix. And so I have to invite people that want to help to be more of a coach. Because in the wilderness, an individual is on their healing journey, and their answers are going to be found by themselves from within and through the grace that shows up in their life. And so I'll just jump to this. This is the coaching script that I teach the families I work with. And I actually teach my clients, too, because sometimes they have to coach their co-parent. Sometimes their co-parent's off on some, you know, detour and is lost. And so I have them learn four letters, the letters that spell out help. And when you're a coach, you become masterful at asking questions. And so When I go get training by all the coaches that have trained with me over the years, it's a training in questions. And so H stands for what's happening. And E is for emotion. What are you feeling? L is what therapists do so well. It's the validation question. It looks like you're feeling sad, agitated, frustrated, confused. But P is what separates the therapist from the coaches. P is what is your plan? And you ask that of whoever you're coaching. You know, what's your plan? What's your way out? What are some of the ideas you've had to solve this struggle that you're in? And you know you're being a great coach when they start asking for your ideas. Then you've established empathy and trust. But that's my coaching script, and I teach it to everybody. Because many times, children especially, in the trauma and struggle of a divorce, get so lost. And it's so important for me to teach the parents to coach with their children. And you can do it as young as 4 or 5. Just helping them heal and struggle in a constructive way with their grief, with their, you know, everything that has been shattered in all their expectations of childhood. And so we do, that's why we do kids coaching in our practice. I love the book Option B by Sheryl Sandberg. And that book was written, it's a story of her grief in losing her husband. But divorce is a grief story. And so it's an excellent book. And one of the great, great parts of the book is people, when people are struggling with grief, with divorce, with the loss of a spouse, people don't know how to help. They really don't. And this book was written to help everyone have an understanding of grief. And her favorite question was when people would ask her, "How is your day going?" Because when you're in grief, you're only going hour by hour, day by day. And so, you know, she got frustrated when people would say, "How are you?" Okay? Like she couldn't do anything with that. But she loved when people would ask, "Well, how's your day going?" And she really felt like they cared. It's so important if someone's struggling in divorce, for you to become an ally. Like, don't avoid. Like, step in and just be with them. And just being an ally, just having love and support, and even saying nothing, just being in their space of grief. And listening, being a sounding board, is very, very helpful. And my husband always says, listening is fixing, you know. If you really are a fixer, you just have to, you know, transition to listening is fixing. And then, you know, enjoy the wilderness. I've loved the wilderness. It's creative, and you don't know what grace is going to come your way. My husband and I sometimes will do some couples coaching. Usually, they've been clients of mine, and now they're scared to death to get married again. And so we sort of help guide them into some hope and with some mountain climbing skills to put together a blended family, which is always a very creative, adventurous experience. And so we invite them to have wilderness marriages, especially if they're going to remarry, because that's what it is. That's what shows up, is a wilderness marriage. And trying to blend kids. And I'll just share just some fundamental things about remarriage and blending families. Is if you have little, tiny, younger kids, like 12 and under, you'll actually have some success in blending. But a step-parent has to come in as a friend. and not become a disciplinarian. You have to stay very much in a circle of friendship with your stepchildren to have success. And then you have to give yourselves 5 to 7 years to put a family together. And it just takes so long for all the pieces to get put in place. And then in a remarriage where you're blending kids, you have to accept that you will never, ever be a nuclear family, okay? You'll be a family where children come and go all the time. And you have to, like, create a whole new vision for a family that's highly creative. And again, it's best to see it as an adventure. If you have older kids, they don't blend, okay? If you have young adults, if you have teenagers, they don't blend with children they don't know. They don't blend very well with a new step-parent. It just takes a very, very long time to really have what I call moments of family, okay? When you're dealing with teenagers and young adults, you know. We have, with my husband and I, we have 7 children together. I have 3 of my own. He has a son. And then I raised 3 stepkids. So we have a lot of children that we have to create family experiences for. And it's always fun. That's why I bought a house with a pool. You can just throw all these kids and grandkids into a pool, and they can have a great experience, okay? And we have pool parties. And then we do really creative vacations where, you know, we try and go to a spot where I can rent a really big house, and everyone has to get their own cars. I mean, you just do these creative family experiences. So anyway, I just wanted to share some resources, and I'll get back to that. There's a few resources. I know in my practice, I have a trail book that I actually give my clients, and then I do with Sunstone. I've partnered with Sunstone, and we do Brené Brown workshops, and we have a table downstairs because I love doing group work with people that are struggling, and it's just you just heal in a community so well. And if you can create a community of healing, you heal faster. And so there are lots of resources out there. There's just a few. I've always loved the book Mom's House, Dad's House by Isolini Ricci. It's all about, you know, creating a healthy, successful post-divorce life. And so, anyway, this is now a time for questions. Does anyone have any questions?
Do you work a lot with couples who are divorcing because of one has left Mormonism? And so I guess maybe none of this information would change because of something like that. But I guess it's my sister and her husband are kind of going through this. And neither of them have decided yet that they'll divorce over this. But I guess you gave me some great tips to help them. Yeah. I just am at a loss. Like, they both talk to me. Yeah. And so,
yeah, of course they do. And then tell me in the dynamic, has one or both left the church?
So she has.
Okay.
And he is still hanging on by his fingernails. Okay. But she kind of made it an ultimatum to him that he couldn't go to church because she didn't want her kids to go. And so she made this huge divide between them, and it's just so destructive. I can hardly believe she did it. But she has PTSD from her experiences in the church, and so she feels like she's protecting, especially her daughter, from those same things, and she feels like that is more important than keeping her marriage alive. So she's ready to ditch it if it were that situation, but oh, it's so hard to watch.
And again, starting about 5 years ago, this became the number one theme in my practice, is one or both, you know, we're having faith crises, deciding to leave the church. And what complicated it was most of them had been married really young. And so when you start questioning and having a faith crisis and getting into critical thinking, you know, really deep down, you actually question, well, why did I get married in my early 20s? You even question your marriage decision. You question everything. And so this is why it's so important, you know, to see if there's any openness for either couples counseling or coaching, because, you know, when you're in all that trauma, you go very positional, very territorial. It's your primal brain protecting you. And if there's some PA, you know, some post-traumatic stress happening, she's pure primal brain. And you don't understand that there's higher levels of consciousness, okay? Because if you just look at marriage, even if, you know, both spouses are actively religious in any religion, they are going to have their own nuances, okay? Everyone has, spirituality is an individual journey, and your religious practice is an individual journey. And so, you know, what we do when I'm working with couples where we have these differences is I first of all, you know, really coach them to get calm and get into this caring indifference. Calm down. Sometimes I'll do a structured separation where I'll just call a timeout so they can just get their head back, okay, and do some self-compassion. Do lots. Yeah, I've negotiated where they have separate bedrooms in the same house, or we'll do what's called nesting, where you keep the kids in the house, and then they get an apartment, or they go live with a family member, and they go in and out when they're in charge of kids, because the time out is so important to calm down and become that observer. And that's a great time when I have them do individual therapy, okay? Or coaching, whatever they choose to do. And then what I love about being a mediator is I've been trained and then I coach people to be observers of each other's story. And mediation's very therapeutic, where people seek understanding and empathy, and empathy's a skill that I teach. And what's possible is for them to create, like, a new way to be together as a couple, you know, where they do some creative negotiation, and they communicate for understanding, and then they negotiate, well, how are we going to have a mixed faith-type marriage? Because having a spouse, you know, have a faith crisis or not want to be part of like a religious practice does not end a marriage. It doesn't have to end a marriage. But it takes a lot of coaching and creative negotiation. Even if they divorce and they have kids, okay, they're going to have to co-parent in every state. You know, everyone has a right to at least half of the Sundays. And so they'll go 50-50 on weekends. And so even with co-parents, they have to negotiate how they're going to raise children. You know, and so I have some of the most creative parenting plans I've ever done in the last 5 years because of this situation. You know, where I try and get my parents to see the possibility that each of them will give spiritual gifts to their children in different ways. And then if they can just let their children choose. I use the analogy with my parents where after a divorce, each parent is going to create and retreat back to a different foreign country. And sometimes they'll speak different languages. And really, it helps the children to understand why their parents struggle with negotiation and communication, because their parents are from two different foreign countries. And then we invite the children to create a Switzerland for themselves. And in Switzerland, they get to create their own life and their childhood. And then we coach the parents that they have to learn how to visit Switzerland, okay? Because when you really empower children with choice, it's amazing how fast they heal from divorce. Did you have a question?
Do you deal with any highly contentious religious divorce?
Uh-huh, yes.
What are your suggestions for that? I'm divorced
yeah.
2 years, and I'm constantly being taken to court.
Oh, yeah. Great, great. I'm actually a special master with the court. And, yeah. 25% of all divorces get stuck in this swampland. And negative intimacy will lead one or both to litigation. You know, it just fuels it. And so I work with we call them high conflict families. You've been labeled, okay? And you've probably noticed that your judge, the court system, doesn't really care about you. Yeah, yeah, because you're a case number. And most judges, especially here in Utah, like none of them are divorced. They have no empathy. No empathy whatsoever. And the judges I work with tell me they'd rather have a bloody homicide trial than a divorce. They hate divorce because they never know what side is telling the truth, okay? So you just swirl in litigation. What you can do if you're in that swampland, first of all, what age is your youngest child?
13,
okay.
Yeah. My ex-remarried lady was 6.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still fighting actively for that child. He's a powerful, white, LDS businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Just always. I finally gave up with my lawyer and said, I can't keep going back. I can't afford it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You deserve this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't know what you probably didn't
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you're in the swampland, yeah, you fight. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so what's the parent time schedule right now?
He has every other weekend and one weekend.
And is he going for 50-50? Oh, yeah. That's the new thing. It's just
and
making.
Oh,
uh-huh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, lots of issues. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the best place for you is to get to a place of your own peace. What? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And because when the court's involved in your life, you're completely powerless. And the trend is 50-50. And so many times, I'm coaching women right now, sometimes you have to surrender and just accept. And then you learn how to work with a 50-50 schedule and how to influence within your 50% allotment, okay? And that becomes your wilderness experience, okay? In raising all my kids and stepkids, I've tried every parent time schedule, okay? I'm doing 50-50 with my husband's son right now. And my gosh, these schedules are crazy. 50-50 is the craziest I've ever done. But you can have those moments of family and connection, regardless of what schedule it is. But my advice to you, find your peace. Find your peace. And you have to, like, just practice the spiritual concept of surrender, because you don't know what the court's going to do.
No.
Litigation will stop when your youngest graduates from high school. Yeah, that's when it will stop, okay? That's the reality. Yeah, and you just, you know, you just find your own peace, and you try and keep conflict away from your child, which is really hard because they're, you know, they're a teenager. So they're gonna be curious about the conflict, and they're going to be vulnerable to being swayed. And so that's why you can start coaching your child about Switzerland, like create your own Switzerland. Yeah, and you get to have boundaries around your life. And as parents, you know, you just get to visit our foreign country. But then you're going to... Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's always no communication in high conflict. But you can work with your son. You can coach with him and help him do this same mountain climb, you know. Get to a point where he's an observer and he's not feeling torn in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and because he's a boy, he's figuring out the world of men and his father, and you're going to have to give him permission. Yeah, just give him permission. And then, yeah, you do what you can. I have a son with my second husband, and he was in a huge dilemma. You know, his father is very active LDS. His mother's in the wilderness, okay? So he found Zelf on the shelf, you know, so he really had quite a little bit of a faith crisis his senior year. But what was more profound for him is he wasn't at peace with his father, okay? He had a traditional schedule. I was home base. He only saw his dad every other weekend. And so he chose to go on an LDS mission to sort of come to peace with everything. And it's been amazing for me to coach him on a mission because he's coming to peace with what his spirituality and religious practice is going to be, his relationship with his father, his relationship with his stepfather. So it's like we're just in the wilderness coaching a missionary. And it's been profound because, you know, here I'm sort of post-Mormon supporting my son on an LDS mission. But what he's doing is he's coming to peace. He's creating his Switzerland. And so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am active LDS and was divorced after 27 years of marriage. I've come to grips with it, and my husband, my ex-husband, and I are still okay friends. I have trouble dealing with the stigma that still exists in the church, and I'm just struggling with that. I can barely go to Relief Society. Do you have any tips for that? I don't know if there's any way to get through.
And again, And I've been where you are, you know. I've been active LDS, being a single mom, being divorced. And what I had to learn in my wilderness is I was allowing shame to envelop me, okay? And so that's why I discovered and needed Brené Brown, because she's all about how you become resilient and how you start disappearing the shame. You know, I'm to the point, my relief society won't release me, okay? I when I was in the wilderness, I taught Brené Brown for a year as a relief society teacher. And the lessons were so interesting and so exciting, like they won't release me. So, but because I'm sort of post-Mormon, they've put me on the homemaking committee. So I teach once a year. And what I've been experimenting with for my own self is being more and more authentic and just showing up with no shame. You know, here I am. I'm on a third marriage. I have this wild and crazy family. You know, and I just share always and practice authenticity. And that has helped me more than anything disappear the shame in my life. Is you have to first own it, okay. And then you break free and you practice being authentic. So I'll try that. And then I think we need to wrap up.
I think we are wrapping up. Thank you so much for all of you that have attended. And thank you, Liz. That was excellent.